This show is about spoilers and discussion. It's also about spooky things that are best enjoyed after you see the movie. So any movie we talk about, we recommend you go see. You've been warned.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
The horror. There is no shortage of monsters to haunt our dreams.
The horror.
You got red on you.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
The horror.
Alive, it's alive!
Groovy.
Welcome to Oh the Horror, a horror movie podcast where we get a casual's perspective and a fan's perspective on all things horror. I'm your host, Rob Holmes.
And I'm the casual, Steve Allman.
And today, we are talking about the Friday the 13th franchise. Now, we're only going to be talking about parts 1 through 8, better known as the Paramount franchise, because after 8, the rights went over to New Line, and we got things like Jason Goes to Hell, but this was solely taking place in the 1980s, 1980
oh boy.
Through 1989.
Rob, what did you make me do?
I made you watch 8 movies.
Yeah, I watched 8 movies. All of these were made in the 80s.
All of these were made in the 80s, absolutely.
Every single one of them.
Well, it's interesting because out of all franchises that you look at, when you look at Child's Play, that went from the 80s into the 90s. You look at Hellraiser, that went into the 80s, the 90s, even now into the 2000s. You look at Halloween, that started in 78 and went up until the late 2000s and then got rebooted again. And Nightmare on Elm Street started in the 80s, ended in the 90s, and then got rebooted again after that. If you're looking at one franchise that the original 8 movies is where it was originally just supposed to end. That was the Paramount franchise. It's the only one that fully takes place in the 1980s.
And it's amazing to think because we got Friday the 13th Part 1.
Correct.
In 1980 or 1981, I believe.
1980.
And seemingly for about the entire decade, we got one right after the other.
Absolutely. And it's a little strange to think about because this movie series can be split up in a lot of different ways.
Right.
It's not just... So if you were to watch these films, you could watch Friday the 13th by itself. And it's a great standalone film.
It's actually surprisingly good. I thought I had zero expectations for how good that first
right.
one was going to be. And it was completely subverting every single one of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you get into... So, as most of you know, in the original Friday the 13th, if you've seen Scream, we know that the killer is Pamela Voorhees, which is Jason's mom. So, in the film, what she says was back in the 50s, her son had drowned. She ended up killing these counselors. She blames the counselors for her son drowning. And then the next year when they tried to open, there was a bunch of fires. They couldn't open. 30 years later, they decide, hey, we're going to reopen this camp, and Steve Christie is going to have a bunch of counselors come in to train right before all the campers get in there. And one by one, they all start getting taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's interesting because the premise, or at least the reveal of this first Friday the 13th, it's interesting because it's kind of like a reverse Psycho.
Yeah.
You think it's one way, and then it's completely the other, where you've been taught to think, or at least me knowing that it's a Friday the 13th movie, I've been taught to think, okay, this is clearly Jason's
yeah.
work. This is the big bad crazy guy, the hockey mask, all that stuff. And none of that has happened.
Not even close.
And so we have basically the kind mother from from Psycho.
Yeah.
Telling everybody that no, you killed my son. I'm the sweet old lady that's going to be killing all of these kids.
Right.
And that's an amazing sort of turn of events for the first movie in this horror franchise to go. When the exact character that you are is synonymous with the franchise isn't even in the first one.
Oh, absolutely. I find it to be really interesting because when this film was still made or about to be made, and they had just Sean Cunningham really just made a poster and put that out there and was like, it's called Friday the 13th. What's it about? We don't know. And then from there, built the film out so it could get distribution and he could sell the distribution rights for it to raise the money to make the film.
And that's insane to me, because before a movie was even made, one sheet was made.
Right.
And that in turn had to sell an entire movie to be made.
That's how it was back in the 70s and 80s. A lot of the time it was you make up a mock-up of the poster and you give it a cool title, you make it look interesting, and you try to sell distribution rights, either domestic or foreign.
See, because I'm a huge poster fan myself. I love, like, some of the subtle art that's making a good one-sheet. Yeah. And I think, the fact that that piece of art can dictate whether or not a film's made.
Yeah.
Let alone if it's, like, because you'd think about it being sold to you as in, like, oh, this will get me in the theater. Like, this looks cool enough to make me want to go see. Because back in the day, that's all people had to go on. But it's interesting the way that this piece of artwork can dictate whether or not a movie is being made. And it's an iconic image. That poster is, like,
absolutely
is legendary. So that being put aside, this is an amazing sort of first premise for this franchise to kick off with. And I don't know, did they have an idea that they were going to incorporate Jason into these subsequent sequels? Or was it, oh, this is a hit, now we've got to run with it more?
You know, I remember, so there's a documentary called Crystal Lake Memories. So we're not going to get too much into detail about some of the trivia and facts. I highly recommend for all the listeners out there to watch Crystal Lake Memories. It's about a 6.5-hour documentary going through every film in detail. There's also another shorter documentary called His Name is Jason, which is about an hour long, and it gives a little more information on that. I can say just from memory, I don't think they knew what this film was going to do. I don't think they knew it was going to be as big of a success. So the idea of having Jason not having drowned, having somehow, because they never found his body.
Right.
So having him have some sort of trauma from this supposed drowning and then living in the woods kind of as a mountain man for the past 30 years.
Or some sort of feral kid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he obviously grew up.
Right.
But going from being a feral kid to becoming this adult, finding clothes and everything that he needed from there, and learning how to survive and getting those survival tactics. Then at the end of the first one, in order to lead into the second, the idea is that he saw his mom get beheaded and now has gone crazy and wants revenge against anybody who sets foot in his wilderness near Camp Crystal Lake.
Right. And that's sort of enforced with the camp story that happened in the second one.
So, yeah, in the beginning of the second one, Alice, who's the survivor of the first film, in the beginning, this is the one thing I don't understand, how he makes it to the suburbs and is
able
to... Right,
because he's kind of just there.
Right. And he's able to dispatch of Alice very quickly with an ice pick to the head, in her house, with the head, his mother's head, in the fridge, when she opens it up and she sees that, and then he kills her and she's gone. All of a sudden we jump to this camp. What we don't realize, unless you really listen to the dialogue very carefully, is that the second film takes place 5 years later. Like, her disappearance and her death takes place 2 months later after the first film, but then we jump ahead 5 years.
And so, and that's another kind of cornerstone to this horror franchise, is that this is kind of the franchise of the slapdash and outlandish continuity errors.
So, yeah, it all led to a bunch of continuity errors over time. And what most people, you know, we all know that Jason gets his iconic mask. And that's actually all people really are like, oh, the hockey mask. Jason always had the hockey mask. That's not true.
It's totally not true, actually. Like, the amount of times, at least in the first four movies, that we see him with the mask, you've only got one movie where he's in full mask.
So in the second one, he's known as Sackhead Jason. There's one hole, one eye hole that he looks through.
Right.
And that's how we know him. It isn't until the third film that we finally get the Jason that we know with the hockey mask. And it's because one of the guys, Shelley, has been trying to prank everybody and pull all this stuff on people because he's the jokester of the group, just trying to get attention. And he ends up wearing this hockey mask and scuba suit, hockey mask, and a spear gun. I don't know how those all go together, but apparently they
and
do.
How do you get those into a lake house in the wilderness?
When he literally just had his box, he's like, "This is my box full of stuff."
Like, and you have a harpoon gun in the fucking box.
I'm like, is it a TARDIS? Like, is it really that much bigger on the inside? So he ends up pulling that. Jason finally gets his iconic mask that we know of, and that kind of starts it. That's where we know Jason is being this masked killer, and it's really cool. I mean, but, you know, we have to go through a few films before he finally gets it.
And being like an outsider kind of looking in on this franchise for the first time, I expected this to get, I guess you could say, lore heavy.
Right.
For Jason himself. Because I was like, okay, so he's this, like, at least from, I got from one and two, it's just like, all right, so he was this feral kid
right.
lived out in the wilderness, and he's just gone crazy and wants to kill everybody. All right, well, where do you go with that? And it's interesting because any lore that you kind of get or any sort of emboldening canon that's kind of laid on Jason happens at sort of the tail end of each movie, where anything that actually remains true or builds the sort of character or legacy of Jason happens like within the first or, like the first or last 5 to 10 minutes of each movie, and then the rest is kind of superfluous teen romp sort of like misgivings, and then they get killed
right
for no reason.
Right. So yeah, they all keep going out to different places. Now what's interesting is that in 2 through 4, those films take place over the course of like a week.
Yeah, and the action and the speed at which things keep going is kind of breakneck.
Yeah. So it's, you know, Jason goes to this camp, Ginny is the survivor, there's Paul, who we don't know what happens to him. So this is something that kind of bothers me. Steve Miner directed parts 2 and part 3. Now, some people say that when Ginny is attacked, after she hits Jason with the machete and they leave him for dead, they go back to the house or go back to a cabin. They hear a knock at the door. It turns out it's the dog that has disappeared that everyone thought was dead, but it's not. And then Jason pops through the window without his hood, without the sack on, and he has long hair, and he has a machete still embedded in him. Steve Miner directed the third one as well, and in the beginning of that, the intro is the machete's already out of Jason when he crawls away, and next time we see him, he doesn't have any hair. So when did he get this time to cut all his hair off? But people's excuse for that is, well, maybe it was a dream. She went to sleep and she had a nightmare, and when the cops finally showed up the next day, she had kind of lost it a bit.
And in a weird way, the movies kind of ran with that idea almost for every single one after 2. Even after 1, you
could
say.
But we never find out what happens to Paul, though.
Right.
So is Paul in another ambulance, or did Jason actually come through, attack, and then Paul ended up getting killed, and then Jason somehow ran away without killing Ginny, which doesn't really make a lot of sense. But when you're trying to make sequels after you've already put something on film and released it, I guess that's the best way to go about doing it.
So me seeing these movies like almost in sequence over the course of 2 nights,
yeah,
I kind of went a little like crazy and kept thinking of like, oh, they're doing something really smart here. Like Jason is kind of this weird amalgamation of everybody's fears, where after like when the last person is standing, like they get to see this wild hallucination of what yeah. Jason may or may not do, and then it turns out to be something different, and Jason was just like the idea or concept of Jason was a lot more simple
right.
than it really is. So like everybody having a sort of dream sequence or mystery like thing happen to them just before the movie ends, like that kind of just throws it into the almost supernatural, is kind of actually amazing. I kind of like that. It keeps a sort of Twilight Zone-y sort of vibe to the entire franchise, where things don't exactly always feel like what they seem.
It always gets a little strange, though, because in the third one, when Chris Higgins, the survivor from that one, she goes out in a canoe, just kind of like in the first one, and you're expecting Jason's going to pop out of the water, but it's the mom who pops out of the water, yet she's decapitated, so it's strange, and Chris didn't even know that. So how is this part of her dream that this would even happen? But then she ends up getting taken off to, I guess, a mental institution because she's completely lost her mind. She's laughing maniacally at the end of it, and they end up taking her away. And you still see that Jason has the axe that she embedded into his head there.
Right.
So at this point, we're like, all right, Jason must be dead. Nope. Because then right away, he gets taken to the morgue for in Friday the 13th for the final chapter, which to me, out of all of the first four, I would say the first one is the best. And then any of the Jason ones from 1 through 4, 4 is just amazing. You have a great cast of characters. You have Crispin Glover. You have Corey Feldman.
4 has an amazing cast and kind of an amazing setup.
Yeah.
And it's probably the most technical showcasey outside of 3, I want to say, because 3 was very clearly, like, if I didn't know this was called Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D, the movie certainly showed me it with every single thing being shoved
every,
at the screen.
Popcorn being there, the, he holds the eye over to the camera. Yeah, 3 has its moments.
Very gimmicky, though.
Very, very, very gimmicky. And it's a thing that happens every 30 years, it seems, like 50s, 80s, you know, right. 2000s. And it kind of worked, I guess, at the time. It was probably really cool. It has the best music out of all. The intro theme.
It actually does.
The intro theme for the third movie is fantastic.
But it's also, it bookends the actual movie, and we don't get that score really anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because it's very kind of thunderous and very 80s and
very
synthy 80s. And kind of weird, because then we have this sort of generic almost 50s like dun 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 it dun it for like a
for
lot
ones,
of the movie.
Yeah.
For a lot of the actual interim of the show. But then once the credits hit, you're like, oh, I'm back in the 80s with kind of this funky synth sound, and I'm like, where is this coming from? Like, this is great.
Yeah. It was, I mean, it's fantastic, which is why, you know, there's a lot of people who don't like 2. There's a lot of people who don't like 3 very much. I think they're completely necessary because each one has its own individual individuality to it.
Right.
You know, you have the first one. It's Pamela's film, essentially. The second one is Sackhead Jason. The third is the origin of how he gets the mask. And the fourth is how he's finally defeated by a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing. And the fourth one has some of the best deaths in it. It's very creative kills. And, I mean, Crispin Glover's amazing. He's absolutely amazing.
I love that he plays that just, like, not so much whiny, but, like, kind of impotent and, like, sniveling sort of nerd character. But he's also gorgeous, so he's actually, like, he's just, like, the kind of, like, it's a character that you could easily empathize with
right.
and get on his side. He does a very amazing job, probably the best well-acted of the Friday the 13th
Oh, absolutely,
movies.
Absolutely. I mean, his acting...
Not only because of the star power, it's actually because of it's a good team dynamic that they have there.
Yeah, his acting in it is fantastic, and the film itself is great. We finally get to see Jason again unmasked, and the machete to the head, and that slow slide down the machete blade of his head twitching as he's just falling into the blade and it's
right,
cutting
yeah.
away at him, and you're like, holy shit. And then Tommy Jarvis, young little Tommy Jarvis, goes fucking crazy just hacking the shit out of Jason for a while, and you're like, this kid has gone insane. But they've also pulled the same trick multiple times now. We had in the second one, Amy Steele's character of Ginny puts on the sweater and is like,
right.
I'm Pamela Voorhees, Jason, I'm your mom. And then
which is a fine thing to do.
It's a fine thing to do, but then to cut back to it to be like, Jason, I'm gonna cut all my hair off. Hey, I'm you. And it's like, obviously, how are you me?
So this is just, he's just dumb.
I mean, yeah, he's not the smartest, but
no.
But he does know, he's very creative, apparently, with making sure that, and same with Pamela, that when someone walks out at a certain point in the film, bodies happen to fall once they hit a certain area. Or they know that they're going to run here and find a body, you know, up in the rafters, and blood's going to come down at some point. I mean, when the guy gets split in half in the third one, Andy, I think is his character's name, he gets split in half when he's walking on his hands.
Right.
You would expect when the girl comes out of the shower to see blood all over the floor or anything. I don't know how Jason
Clean as
did
a whistle.
It. Clean as a whistle. Doesn't notice anything. It's all fine. And then a drop of blood slowly with his half cut, his body that's been like split down from the legs to his gut, little bit of blood.
That and the fact that he had to climb up into the rafters
to
toss actually
the body up there.
To toss the body up there just to strategically put his body just so that she knows that exactly where to look up in the hammock.
Right.
It's like that's the sort of fun that I expected to see.
Right.
And I got that, again, in the interims, but again, I think that the interesting thing that needs to be discussed about when we talk about the Friday the 13th, mainly in the kills, is I kind of expected more of the sort of ironic, funny, like, oh, this character has a shtick, and there's going to be, like, some sort of, like, a gimmicky way that they die that's kind of synonymous to their character. But no, it's just kind of dumb.
Yeah. So, at this point, after the fourth film, Jason is dead. Originally, that was it. The fourth film was supposed to end all of it. Jason Voorhees is dead.
Dead. Now, did they show any intention of wanting to continue with more sequels after four? Because it was called The Final Chapter. It seemed very conclusive at the end, but I didn't know if this is any sort of the studio executives is like, okay, we're going for another sequel because it was a hit or what have you. Because again, they seem to be keeping this up.
Well, when these films do pretty well, so they want to keep bringing these things back. So what ended up happening was they wanted to bring back a character to keep the franchise going. And they thought a really interesting way to do that would be to bring back Tommy Jarvis. Except Tommy Jarvis is now 5 years older. He's 17. He's been committed and is... he was committed for 5 years, and now he's kind of at a halfway home.
Mm-hmm.
And in this one, the original concept for it was Tommy was going to be becoming Jason because of all the traumatic effects that happened. He would end up becoming the killer. And in the film, they kind of allude to him losing his mind. He keeps seeing Jason throughout. And what you'll know about this is the one most people hate. I mean, really hate, because it's fake Jason.
Right.
So Roy.
But if that's the only reason, I feel like that's kind of unfounded.
Because I think in this one, there's a lot of positives to it. So what happens in this one is that at the halfway home, this guy, Vic, ends up, killing this guy Joey with an axe, just because he has a lot of anger issues, and Joey keeps being like, hey, you can have some of my candy bar, and he cuts it in half with an axe, and he's like, that's real mean, and Vic is like, well, fuck you, and chops him into pieces with an axe.
Right.
And there's a paramedic who ends up going there, is Roy Burns. Well, what we don't find out until later at the end of the film is that Roy was actually Joey's father and had put him hadn't seen him, I guess, in years. And had, like, I guess, disappeared and kind of just kept an eye on the kid
it's
alluded to a little bit. They kind of talk about it.
If there's any reason that you want to hate on this movie, it's probably because of the weak storytelling. And that's by Friday the 13th standards, where Jason doesn't even show up until the latter half of every single movie, where you've been kind of just watching people not get killed for a half hour.
Well, no, I mean, you get a kill or two right off the bat in any of these films.
Right.
Jason always is going to end up killing at least one or two people in the beginning. You get to know the characters a little more. The second you hit the 45-minute mark, shit just starts getting out of control.
Right.
And that's where you get a bunch of kills from there. Now, in A New Beginning, they wanted to have a kill every 6 minutes. That was the idea.
Jeez.
Because they thought the more kills, the better. Now, I think this is a great one. It has some of the most creative deaths out of all of them.
True.
You get the garden shears to the eyes. You get the belt around the tree, crushing the head that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even when, and you don't just have Jason killing people. You have, like, when Vic kills Joey, like, right in the beginning with the axe. It's super violent, super visceral. And you're like, holy shit, what am I getting into?
Uh-huh.
And then from there, people just start showing up dead left and right. You have the two guys on the side of the road. One gets the flare to the mouth. One gets his throat slit. You have all of these more innovative deaths than just, hey, I'm going to stab someone, or hey, I've hit them with a machete. You get some more variety in your kills.
Yeah, and I think that what that movie makes up for in kills, it lacks in actual tension.
Yeah.
Because it just keeps happening. Like, well, you're expecting it now at this point.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, Demon ends up getting impaled through the port-a-john. And it's just, it's innovative, it's different, you're seeing different parts, not just these campers, or not just, you know, this group. In this one, it's not even campers, it's just, instead of just being at this halfway home, you're getting all of these other people who are around the area involved, people in the trailer parks, people on the side of the road. So it definitely isn't Jason's MO so much, it's more Roy just went fully batshit crazy and just started killing everybody,
mm-hmm.
using the Jason Voorhees,
you know, makeup and mask
and everything like that. And the reason that a lot of people know it's, you know, fake Jason is it has, instead of the red triangles on the mask, this one has blue ones.
Right.
And what you notice that throughout the film, because every time Tommy ends up going into or having a weird hallucination, he always imagines Jason with the red ones. and the original like slash in the side of the mask now, from where the axe is.
I gotta give him props for that, because that's actually a good, like, recognizing that material. Like, okay, this is fake. This is like, it's like that Inception thing where it's like, right. Oh, only the top falls on, like, right. You know, that conspiracy theory stuff I actually like, because it's like, oh, the red dashes make it the real Jason and the fake one is the blue.
Now, Roy takes a shit ton of battle damage. Like, yeah. He...
The famous action figure phrase, battle damage.
Holy shit. I mean, he gets hit with a chainsaw, he gets stabbed a few times, he's still going at it. And then finally, I think the way that he meets his maker by getting thrown off and impaled on those spikes below, on that spike bed, I thought that was great.
Now, I forget, because we give Jason a pass for taking all of this type of battle damage because he's this super strong, like, Mega Man from the woods that have just survived on stuff. He could take hits and all this stuff. But is there a reason that this guy can just survive? Like, did we actually... Like, I can't even remember if it was explained to me. I was just so focused on people dying.
So, in which ones?
In Fake Jason.
In Fake Jason, no. I think it probably just had to do... He didn't really get this battle damage until later in the film.
Right.
And it seemed that that was the final climax, so you're just kind of wondering, all right, well, Jason could always take a lot of hits. This guy's taking a lot of hits, too, and it's probably just the rage from having his son killed.
Uh-huh.
Now, I think 5 has some of the best death sequences out of all of them. I think it's very fast-paced. You get a lot of cool stuff going on in there. It's got some decent music going on in it as well.
Uh-huh.
But it's a little different. It's a little more variety to it. He really does pull the I'm going to throw bodies through stuff, the same Jason MO. But you also get to keep the character of Tommy Jarvis, which is really, really cool.
Uh-huh.
Now,
but then we move on to the next one.
So we move on to Jason Lives, which takes place about a year later. So Tommy Jarvis is, I guess, almost stable at this point. And he and Horshack, because it's the guy who played played Horshack on Welcome Back, Kotter, decide, played by a different actor. So Tom Matthews ends up playing Tommy Jarvis in this one.
Right.
You know him from Return of the Living Dead and Return of the Living Dead Part 2 fame.
It's fun to see the actors that have been in this movie to actually look at their, like, Amazon IMDb things. Because, like, every time I move the mouse, it's like, oh, this guy was actually in this. Interesting.
Yep. So at this point, Tommy Jarvis, I guess, didn't end up killing the girl at the end of the fifth one.
Yeah.
Because you see him put the mask on and you're like, he's insane now. He's lost his mind, or was it just a dream? I guess they kind of threw that by the wayside and they're like, look, let's just go straight to Tommy Jarvis now. Like, he's mainly stable again.
Yeah. And this movie has been where the sort of middling bookending plot points of the legacy of Jason, or in this case, Tommy, they start to feel a little lame.
Sure.
At this point.
Well, this is where I get really interested in it, because now we have undead Jason.
Uh-huh.
So Tommy wants to kill Jason once and for all. He decides to dig up the grave and ends up stabbing him with part of a fence post that gets struck by lightning twice and ends up reanimating Jason, making him super strong and basically an immortal. So now he's stronger than ever before.
Uh-huh.
He gets his mask back. And he's now going to go back and try and go to Camp Crystal Lake, because it's now been reopened. Now it's called Camp Forest Green. And he's going to go on a killing spree again. And he starts taking out the counselors one by one.
Right.
Now, Jason Lives is amazing. That intro scene, I mean, they even parody the 007 intro when it goes up into his eye and you see Jason walk in like James Bond would. And instead of shooting his gun in the center, he throws the machete forward.
Right.
And I mean, I just think it's great.
Right. And it's a far cry from, like, 1 and 2, where it's more suspense-y. Like, this has gotten almost cartoonish.
Well, it's campy
and
a little bit.
And yeah. But it's seeing all of this in one fell swoop.
Yeah.
It's kind of maddening to see where that would go. Because it's very episodic, the way that these movies' tone changes, especially after 4.
Yeah.
But this one, it just gets... crazy.
It gets crazy, but it gets fun. Like, you
yeah.
end up, in this one, you have Alice Cooper doing the theme, Man Behind the Mask.
Right, yeah.
Which is, I love it.
I think it's dumb and funny.
When I first heard it, when I first started watching the films, I was like, this is the stupidest thing ever.
Yeah.
But the more I've listened to it over time, I'm like, this is great. The fact that Alice Cooper was like, yeah, I'm going to write a theme song for a Friday the 13th movie that totally parallels everything about the character of Jason.
This is clearly the entry in the franchise where they just threw their hands up and they're like, fuck it, man. I don't know. Like, he's a zombie now and he's super strong. Fuck it.
But they had,
like,
a lot of fun with it. You end up with the three paintballer decapitation. You end up with a lot of really cool scenes and a lot of just random deaths throughout the movie. And they do throw in just a ton of people who are just around getting killed before he even gets to the camp.
Yeah.
It's
a weird, like, sort of Jason road trip to destiny here.
And one of my favorite moments in the film is when he's in the camper. And two of the characters are driving back because he's pulled power out from there. And he ends up taking the girl's head and then pushes it into the mirror. And you just see the metal on the side of the camper just push out with her face. And it's like, holy shit. They didn't even need to show the gore on that.
No, it's just that the pressing effect alone
is like, what the hell?
And it gets me back to actually appreciating that. Again, we talk about the technical showcase of a lot of these movies. Probably not since 3 or 4 did we see this amount of, like, creativity, you could say.
I would say 5 had a ton of creativity. 5, some of the deaths were, like, more creative than anything that you get from a lot of the other movies, because a lot of the other ones are, he stabs someone, that's it. He cuts off a head or whatever, that's it. 5 got very innovative with some of the types of kills that you had to deal with.
Right, but I like, at least in 6, where we have, like, at least a sort of, like, a nice little scene before we have that sort of... Like, because, again, it happens too fast.
Yeah.
A kill every 6 minutes, you're not going to have enough time to actually establish anything. Really.
No. You introduce a character, they die.
And with this one, you actually get, like, okay, we've seen people and we know a few names before people get offed.
Yeah.
And that's actually, I like the it's paced well.
Yeah.
And that actually accounts for a lot to me
saw. It does. And I think 6, once he finally gets to the camp, and we actually get the police involved this time. So the police are actually going after and know that Jason does, in fact, exist. Of course, all of the police get killed off. So they don't really realize it for very long.
I was expecting a sort of, like, mask, like, Cuban beat dance number, and then he starts killing everybody. Anyway, that would have been really fun.
What I really liked about that one is that Tommy finally gets his revenge on Jason in the way he sees fit about sending him home, sending him back to the lake.
Right.
Now, his way of doing it is kind of arbitrary. Like, I have a giant rock. I brought some chain.
Well, what am I going to do with this?
I'm going to light a circle of fire around the boat.
It's
and I'm gonna end up somehow getting this around his neck and hope that it drags him down and takes him out.
Yeah, it's a big long plan.
And then Megan is able to finally get the motor into Jason's neck, and I guess breaks his neck or snaps it to the side,
right,
rendering him ineffective. But then at the end of the movie, you see his eye open again, and you're like, all right, Jason's never gonna fully be dead, but at least he's down there for the time being. Then we jump forward a ridiculous amount of time.
I thought you were gonna pause again.
So we jump forward a ridiculous amount of time. It is now the year 2000.
Right. And I love, if there's anything I love in movies, it's a future recreation of the year 2000.
Yeah, well, all these movies, except for the first one, take place in the future from when they were filmed.
Right. But you still get, like, it still feels quintessentially 80s.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was the epitome of the 80s, because I don't really think...
But it's not like we got, okay, this is the 90s. Here's future 90s. No, it's the 80s, but we're saying it's the 90s.
I don't think they fully analyzed it.
Yeah.
You know, and
no,
we're
they
like,
didn't.
This is going to take place in this year. Let's make sure. I mean, these are low budget films.
Yeah, exactly.
The budgets go between $250,000 up to about $5 million. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted to do something different with the new blood. So Tina Shepherd, when she was, I guess, 10 or something like that, ended up having, she's a telekinetic. It's strange, but her dad's an abusive father. She decides to go out to Camp Crystal Lake. Jason is been under there for a few years and still just, you know,
sure.
just hanging out. No one's decided to dredge the lake to see if Jason was actually down there or do anything with him, whatever. So Tina ends up using her telekinesis to make the dock. Her dad runs out to the dock to be like, Tina, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. And Tina's like, I wish you were dead. Starts shaking the dock like crazy. He ends up falling in, gets hit in the head with some of the lumber and stuff or the wood from the dock, and dies. They don't dredge his body up either. They just are like, oh, he's dead. So we cut to 2000. She's now 17. She's returning to Crystal Lake with her mom and her therapist. Mm-hmm. Now, next door, there's a bunch of teenagers who are having a surprise party for this guy, Michael, who's one of their friends. So Tina, I guess, decides she's really upset about everything that's going on, you know, because Dr. Cruz is trying to use her telekinetic powers for, I guess, his own
evil reasons.
I guess for his own reasons, mainly to like maybe get published in papers or to get rich off of it or whatever.
Right, he'll find a way to do something
for his own benefits. Yeah. And she's, you know, getting aggravated by this because he heightens her emotions to a point where she can use her telekinesis.
Right.
So she is upset. She goes down to the docks. She tries to, I guess, resurrect her dad. Lo and behold, she ends up resurrecting Jason. And now Jason is back again.
So I think the thing that needs to be stressed about this one, I think the best thing that it gave us that came out of this movie is that we get a matchup.
Yeah.
Between Jason and what is essentially Carrie.
Yeah, it's Carrie versus Jason.
Yes. Yeah. And I think this kind of kicks off the idea of like this sort of horror icons versus each other.
Well, originally,
or at least the idea. I see the inkling of the idea here.
So originally, the idea was, at least from what I remember, this was supposed to be Freddy versus Jason.
Like, this was actually supposed to be Freddy versus Jason.
I'm pretty sure that the ideas that were going around at the time was this was going to be Freddy versus Jason, but there was an issue, I think, with the rights between New Line and Paramount, getting this stuff to kind of work together.
Like cohesion,
get this to be cohesive, because it's like, who would win? Mm-hmm. I think there was the argument at the time of...
Because this brand wants their guy to win.
Who
this brand
win.
Wants their
yeah,
guy to win.
Because they're both at their peak at that point.
Of popularity, right.
Right. So this was a way that they wanted to revitalize Jason by having him go against Lar Park Lincoln's Tina Shepard. And it's interesting. I mean, he's battling a telekinetic. This is when Kane Hodder became Jason. He's the most iconic of all the Jasons. He was in 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Because we don't actually have a synonymous actor to go with Jason, really, until this movie.
Until this film. He's the only guy who's played Jason more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a physical presence to Jason that really works. I think the makeup effects for Jason in this are by far the best.
True.
Like when he gets out of the water and you see the spine is curved to the side.
Right. It looks cool.
When she finally has his mask break apart on his face, he looks awesome.
Yeah.
Like he emotes really well as the character. You finally feel that Jason is this.
He doesn't look like the fucking Goonies at the end of 3.
Yeah, he doesn't look like Sloth. Yeah.
He doesn't look like Sloth from Goonies at the end of 3. Because that was hysterical.
It was pretty ridiculous. And then in 4, you know, he still has that, like, sloth-like look to him.
Right, but, like, it's actually, like, augmented and terrifying and scary rather than, like, hey, like, kind of a thing.
So 7 was cool, but 7 kind of seemed like Toolshed Massacre because Jason would disappear. Someone would run out or go wherever. Jason would come back and find another weapon to kill people with.
Right. He has his Batman utility belt, but it's the shed. It's basically.
Now, some of them are cool, like the little party favor, the little the one you blow into, and it's
right.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
And when he gets the girl in the eye with that, it's pretty amazing. The head crush, like we haven't gotten a good head crush since the 3rd film.
And that head crush was a little lame.
It was a little cheesy then, but this
one... You
just
see the eye pop. No.
Yeah, this one was pretty cool seeing the blood come from there.
Right.
And originally, John Carl Bueller, pretty sure I said that right, who the director of the film, this film was way more violent. So when I was in college, Kane Hodder came to my university, and he actually showed a lot of this footage. He showed all the stuff that was cut out of 7. The MPAA ripped 7 apart. 7 was originally extremely gory and extremely violent.
Really?
And over time, it ended up just getting...
Like, you know, ding, cutting, didn't cut, cut this, cut this, cut this.
Cutting room floor, cutting room floor, and just kind of got hacked apart. So they weren't too happy about that. And the scenes that I saw were really cool. It would have added a lot more blood and a lot more gore to the film.
So they reshot most of those kills.
They just trimmed it.
They would cut
away a little early, where you would see when he's bringing down like the machete for the sci-fi rider.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of just stops when it hits his neck.
Right, and it felt a little weird, but I was like, okay, it's keeping with some of that 80s editing of just like, okay, don't show too much because the effect isn't that great.
Yeah, it was slightly choppy just because they weren't able to do.
But the effect was actually good. They just didn't want to show it.
Right, right. But 7 to me was kind of fun. I mean, you have Tina and she's like falling in love with this guy, and everything seems kind of going well between them. And then, Tina and Nick basically have to try and save the day. Tina's mom gets killed. Dr. Cruz gets killed. The way Dr. Cruz ends up dying, like, he ends up killing Tina's mom with this giant weird machete knife, then disappears, comes back later with a weed whacker that's got a saw blade attached to it.
Yeah.
I'm like, where are you going? Like, the girl he ended up killing with the scythe, I think he must have just gone back to that work shed and been
again,
like, hey, look, more tools. I'm going to start using this stuff. But what I find really interesting about Jason by this point, by the time you hit part 6, 7, and 8, he is hiding body parts in the weirdest places. Like in 6, he ends up putting one of the girls' heads inside of the car. So when he opens, when someone opens the door, the head falls out.
Right.
Like, it's like he's pulling tricks on people.
Yeah, he's kind of like using Batman's fear factor to kind of just like terrorize a bit more, which makes no sense.
It's like he's some strange prankster. Like, he just wants to mess with people.
I'm Jason Voorhees. Welcome to Jackass.
Yeah, it's like I'm gonna. Oh, for in the 7th one where one of the guys goes down to get some food and he's totally stoned and he ends up getting killed.
Yeah,
and his girlfriend is up in the bedroom, she disappears, she comes back, and his head is sitting there, just waiting. And it's like Jason's gone up there and been like, I'm going to mess with you. I'm going to put this head right here.
Yep.
And you're like, what the hell are you doing? Okay.
A movie like this makes me want to have a movie where we only follow Jason and what he does.
I would love
that. And like, literally, I just want to see setup and him waiting for like 20 minutes. And then killing somebody, and then going, running away, and then, like, hiding, and then setting something up, and then taking the next tool thing out of the box, and then waiting.
I think that would, to me, that would be amazing, because you want to know how he's doing all this, and there's some sort of, like, sick glee in it that he has to have, because he's very methodical with how he does his kills. Like, he even hides, in the 6th one, behind, like, underneath the window ledge, gets the soda poured on him, and then pops up, pulls the girl out of the window, and twists her head off.
Right, but, like, he's not doing... Like, I don't feel like Jason is doing it... Like, because we're getting a bit more of a personality with him the more and more these things go on.
The deader he gets, the more personality he seems to have.
Exactly, but the personality that he has is almost kind of like an Arnold Schwarzenegger-y, like, sort of, like, cheesy action hero.
Well, Commando.
There's always a pun in something that he kills with, or it's just like ice to see you or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
Like, there's always something that there's some sort of like funny bit that he always kind of adds to it, rather than like, this is sort of like an emotional catharsis for me.
Well, I think that kind of had to deal with, so you had Nightmare on Elm Street at the time.
Yeah.
And Freddy has a lot of quips. So Jason doesn't talk.
Yeah, so you need to have some sort of personality.
You need to have some sort of personality to him, and it's almost like he's this merry prankster who kills everybody.
Right.
So in by the time we get to the end of the 7th one, he's dispatched, you know, all the teens, and it's Carrie versus Jason. So there's this big battle, Home Alone style,
right?
Pretty much of knocking
traps.
In the head.
We got traps.
I think Home Alone probably took some of the stuff from this film, especially the lamp hitting him in the head. He falls in through the stairs.
Hilarious.
It was amazing. And then her starting the fire down there, and finally, like, getting nails shot into his face. You see him pull it out, but there's this anger in his face, too. Like, he's so fed up with everything that's going on.
Hey, Jason, you got killed, bro, a whole bunch. Like, this ain't new.
This is where Kane Hodder added such personality to Jason that it makes Seven one of my favorites, because you get to see Jason just has this energy to him now that he didn't really have in the other films.
Yeah, because if Jason Voorhees needs one thing, it's a little bit of like pep in his step.
Well, you know, I mean, you want something a little more going with it, because you don't want them to just start getting really tired and the form is formulaic.
True.
Granted, it's pretty formulaic to begin with, but each one kind of adds a little bit to it. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the seventh, when the house blows up, holy shit, that explosion was intense.
Yeah.
It was giant. I'm like, I didn't know that a house could blow up like that. What the fuck?
Yeah.
And then she, there's this the final battle on the dock. She ends up resurrecting her father, who, by the way, just has mud on his face and hasn't decomposed at all in the past 7 or 10 years
right.
at all.
Yeah, masks, man. You got to moisturize. Yeah, That's all you need.
Jason decomposes more, but apparently he doesn't. And pulls Jason down, chains him up. That's the end of the film. They both go off and do their own thing. Now, this is the beginning of the end.
For the Paramount franchise, as you would say, it is the end.
It wasn't meant to be.
It wasn't meant to be. So let's...
This is where I'll start talking about a few things. Lar Park Lincoln was originally asked to come back as a character of Tina Shepard. The New Blood was supposed to revitalize the franchise, kind of in the way Dream Warriors did for Nightmare on Elm Street.
Okay.
You end up with a new group of characters coming in where some can transfer onto the sequels.
Mm-hmm. Other than
Tommy Jarvis. They wanted to bring in another character. She asked for a salary bump.
Mm-hmm.
They had a $5 million budget. They said no. So they decided to scrap their original script plan and go away from there. So originally they were going to have Jason's mask as the final one. There was talks about that. It never happened, obviously.
Yeah, that's dumb.
Yeah, because it doesn't deal with Friday the 13th. When I hear Friday the 13th, the series, I think it's going to be like Freddy's Nightmares, where at least Freddy was the host of that, and it still had to deal with some really creepy stuff.
So it was sort of like a weird, like, nightmare gallery, sort of like Twilight Zone-y thing of just hey, have a technical showcase for your TV chops and just like do weird stuff.
Now, Friday the 13th, the series, is not a bad show. It's actually pretty decent.
Okay.
It's not terrible at all. The characters are pretty good, and it's kind of fun. So there's the director, writer at the time, Rob Hedden, had written 2 episodes for Friday the 13th, the series, or a few episodes for that.
Yes.
And wanted to write and direct the next film in the franchise. And Paramount was like, here, do a couple of episodes for... let me do a couple of episodes for Friday the 13th, the series. And they were hesitant on it, but they let him do it.
Okay.
They were happy enough, and they said, cool, you can write and direct part 8. And that's how we get Jason Takes Manhattan.
Okay.
Now,
why did you make me end on this one?
It's because it ends out the 80s franchise. It is so hard to watch, man. I know there's people who love this film. I don't understand why, because it destroys every mythos about Jason.
Well, okay, so
that
you
previously existed.
So I'll talk about that, but like I think that one of the fun things that I'm liking seeing, or that I like hearing people talk about, is kind of how bad of a fall from grace one sort of horror franchise could have.
Yeah.
You have it a little bit with Nightmare on Elm Street, but it kind of keeps the same sort of thing going for most of it. At least from the general consensus that I could find. Friday the 13th had a good long run for about how long would you say that it had had before it started to lose its way?
I would say
right up until this?
I would say it had, a misstep with 5, but as far as the audience was concerned,
right?
6 and 7 brought it back, and it had just a huge misstep with 8, because 8, in the original script, a lot of stuff took place in Manhattan, mm-hmm. in New York City. There was supposed to be the fight with, I think, Julius in Madison Square Garden. That's that was supposed to happen. And it was there was supposed to be Statue of Liberty. There was supposed to be all of these iconic places where they were supposed to end up.
Mm-hmm.
What you end up with is a film that takes place an hour on a cruise ship, an hour and 10 minutes on a cruise ship, 20 minutes in an alley or just back alleyways by a dock or a pier right. area, and 10 minutes or less of him going through Manhattan, because this was filmed in Vancouver. So
right.
behind the scenes, they were like, yeah, Jason takes Vancouver. And it's like, yeah, that because it looks like, Vancouver, it looks like Vancouver the entire yeah. time.
I wanted this because when I hear the title Jason Takes Manhattan, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to get like the same type of like location iconography that I would get with like a Ghostbusters. Like right. I'm going to see crazy cool locations, like train stops, like awesome. Like maybe we'll see Madison Square Garden. Maybe we'll see Times Square.
Right.
Something like that. No. We get a terrible, terrible location every single time.
Yeah.
And that's probably the worst.
I mean, you get a little bit of Times Square.
Right. But like, again, what's the point?
No, there's really not a point. By the time you get to it, you're like, all right, and this
that,
movie's.
That fills in the legal definition of Manhattan for a movie to be. Like
so,
that.
So the reason behind that was that the original screenplay was, you know, much more fleshed out, but budgetary reasons said they couldn't do it. You had a $5 million budget for this film. That was it. That's all they wanted to put into it.
Okay.
So with a $5 million budget, you're expecting, you're not going to be able to film in New York and get all these iconic scenes and be able to rent out Madison Square Garden to film this.
True.
It's going to cost $1 million or something right off the bat just to do that. So they said, all right, let's do it in a cruise ship. I would have said, fuck it, scrap the script and do something different with it.
Because you can't, like, that's money. Like, and how, you need to...
how does a cruise ship end up at Camp Crystal Lake?
In Illinois?
In
what, the in Midwest?
I think New Jersey.
New Jersey, okay.
Okay,
well.
But it goes from Camp Crystal Lake and somehow ends up being able to go into the Atlantic Ocean and end up in New York.
My head is in my face. I'm facepalming
yeah.
into the microphone. Because that's an exhausting thing to go on, but I couldn't quite understand the amount of contrivances, because all movies are contrivances.
Sure.
Like the reason that people stay in a camp just so a murder can happen, that's a contrivance in and of itself. But again, like I'm not talking about the suspension of disbelief just that a cruise ship can go from New Jersey to the Atlantic back to Manhattan. That's not the point, but like the way that you get there is horrible.
Well, the way in this one, Jason becomes completely supernatural. He does not exist in any laws of reality at all. This is where we get teleporting Jason.
Right.
Jason now has apparently the ability to teleport. I guess when he got electrocuted to get brought back to life, he now can do that. So in this one, now let me say this. There's a lot of problems right from the bat, right from the get-go. It's been, now it's the years of, I think, 2001 or 2002.
In the timeline.
In the timeline. In the timeline, I think it's supposed to take place in 2002.
Jesus.
This guy is with his girl on a boat, and he talks about Jason. We get a flashback to Jason, but now Jason looks normal. He looks like a normal kid. He doesn't look the way he looked in the first one. He's not deformed at all. He looks normal. And then the guy's like, oh, I heard a noise. I'm going to go check on stuff. When the girl goes up there to see him, he's wearing Jason's mask with the slash in it that was destroyed 2 years earlier
right.
in the New Blood. Completely gone. So how in the hell did that happen? How did someone know that there was Jason Voorhees, he had this type of mask? Who made these prop replicas that he could get?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't... The logic...
Like, he's not, like, sort of a legend that has become sort of a cultural icon.
No, because the girl had no idea who he was.
Right.
So, there's no logic that goes through this film at all. Mm-hmm. Any logic that existed in any of the other parts of the franchise, and there's, you know, it's hit or miss.
There's a few that go through it.
But now it's completely gone.
Right.
So, Jason's jumpsuit now looks completely different. It's more together, because by the time at the end of 7, it was shredded. So, somehow, while he was underwater in between 7 and 8... It regenerated itself?
Well, and, like, we expect, like, a sort of, like, some sort of battle damage to, you know, continue in the series as it is. Because, like, he'll just become this, like, this black, like, amalgamation of bones and limbs and flesh.
It was, like, I think it was like a greenish jumpsuit or something in 7 or something like a dark green
yeah.
that half was shredded away, but now it's blue and most of it is together. And so now he's going and killing again. His skin now has this pasty, opaque whiteness to it, which
right.
just doesn't look right. It looks strange.
Kills aren't even that good.
The kills are really lame for the most part. But he now can teleport from point A to point B. A guy's running up a ladder, getting really far up there, and you see Jason on the deck
looking up.
2 seconds later, this guy has to be 25 or 30 feet in the air. Jason grabs him and throws him down.
Right.
There's no way Jason is that fast. When the uncle character who got Rennie to, you know, try to make her swim, we'll get into that in a bit, that whole debacle of how Jason supposedly pulled her under. I don't get that. He runs away from Jason. Jason is behind him. He runs into this building, up to the second floor, gets thrown out a window, and Jason is standing there having thrown him out a window.
Yeah.
So now Jason can just appear anywhere. There's no rhyme or reason to why he can do what he can do.
And it's not even like the plot contrivances can even explain this or even make it good enough to follow along with.
No, because Rennie has... So the biggest problem with this film, other than Jason can now teleport, is that Rennie says that she was pulled underwater by this boy. And when you see him then, he has the deformities. And then throughout, each time they show Jason again, he has more and more deformities. He has hair at one point. He doesn't have hair at another point.
I feel like, and because this was the last movie that I had seen, like, I felt like I was, like, this movie was in, like, some sort of, like, wormhole through all continuities of all movies. Like, this was kind of when I was going insane. It's like, oh my God, they're, like, taking every single thing that, like, was shown in every single movie that has come before and just putting it all on screen. And then making it horrible.
Yeah.
Because everything that Jason seems to have been going on through in parts 2 through now.
Yeah.
Are kind of there.
Well, what's great about parts 2 through 7 is that sometimes you get introductions of stuff going on. Like, you recap in part 2 you recap part 1, in part 3 you recap part 2, in part 4 you recap part 3. Mm-hmm. Five,
and then you always leave some sort of breadcrumby thing.
Yeah,
for...
Five has like the intro dream sequence with Corey Feldman in it, and I was like, oh, that's great. Corey Feldman comes back at least for a bit in that. In six, you kind of get a backstory of some of the stuff that had happened, or maybe it starts right away. Seven, you get more of a backstory, and you get all the kills that had happened throughout, and someone's doing, like, a narration of that. In the eighth one, there's a weird narrator in the beginning and at the end. You have no idea who he is. Like,
yeah.
Is he a radio DJ? Are they trying to go back?
Speaks like a radio DJ.
Are they trying to go back to, like, the Warriors, where there's the DJ talking about it, but they never show a DJ?
Mm-hmm.
So, then Rennie has visions of seeing Jason as a child multiple times. Jason reaches through a mirror and grabs her at one point, trying to pull her in like this is Poltergeist or some shit.
And as like, some sort of weird callback to the first one.
Right, or a callback to Lar Park Lincoln having the telekinesis somehow.
Right?
That she could also... Because she could have visions of the future. She had visions of people dying in the seventh one. So you're like, all right, so she has a lot of powers that she hasn't fully tapped into. And maybe that was a bit of the previous script that they threw in there, but it made no sense to me that she would keep having visions of Jason. And then the worst part out of all of it, he gets his mask hit off after she throws toxic waste in his face. He kind of screams, which is weird. The mask comes off and he looks like a deformed Cabbage Patch doll.
Yeah.
He looks ridiculous.
It's hilarious.
And then he gets the toxic waste. Originally was supposed to dissolve him. In the original script, he was going to dissolve into nothing. And he was going to be gone forever. They turn him in. Oh, he screams. Like, you hear him say, mommy, or something like that. Vomits up a bunch of water. And then gets hit with this toxic waste, which magically turns him back into a little boy.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah.
That's where eight to me was the nail in the coffin, and that's when Paramount sold the rights because
they couldn't do anything with it anymore.
It made some money. I think it made about $15 million in the box office, so it did all right. But it killed the franchise.
Well, yeah, it killed the brand, I would say.
Oh yeah,
it killed the sort of, I mean, whatever trust you can keep put in the Friday the 13th movies. Like, it just kind of pissed on it.
I hated it as a kid. I thought, you know, I watched it again yesterday thinking maybe it'll get better. Maybe it won't. No, it was worse this time. It aggravated me so much more. there's some cool iconic stuff in it. Jason looks pretty cool when he has the mask on moving through Manhattan. Like,
right, but that's all built around the iconography that we saw before.
Well, it's built around the fact that Kane Hodder plays such a good Jason. Now, the one thing that doesn't make sense to me is he's on the subway. You think Jason would just kill anybody, because that's what he does. He usually just kills everybody. Instead, he's just walking back past all these people in New York.
And picking people.
Picking whoever he wants to, but he's on a subway, doesn't kill anybody on the subway as they're going through there. He doesn't kill anybody really in the diner except if anyone messes with him. And it's just...
It's a weird... It could have been a weird redemption story, like Jason's getting a job in the big city.
Right.
And then... and he's not going to take any guff from anybody else.
That
he's going to go
on
Broadway.
That would have been a better movie.
Jason takes Broadway. That's what needs to happen.
So, at one point, there's these street kids or street punks or whatever, and they're listening to their music. Jason kicks the boombox, and they're going to start some shit with them.
Yeah.
Instead of Jason killing them right away, for some reason, he turns... flips his mask up. They get scared because of how
he
looks.
He's like a bully.
He pops his mask back down and walks off. And I'm like, you guys are really going for some super cheesy shit at this
point. Yeah, yeah. He's like a bully at this point. It's so funny.
It just didn't... It didn't work. The eighth film, to me, is a complete waste of time. I know there are some people who defend it and they like it. I guess they like the way that it goes.
It had a bit of a Schumacher vibe, if I could put a finger on it.
Like,
it felt just like cartoony in every bad sense.
Like a Batman Forever?
Sure, yeah. A Batman Forever of Jason.
Or you know what? Fuck it. The Batman and Robin of the Friday
sure,
the 13th franchise.
Jason nipples. You may see it. I don't know. So I think let's getting back to the positive. Let's talk about where can we put this overall as a franchise? What's our overall impression here? Because I had an okay time watching most of these movies.
So let's go through 1 through 8 and tell me on a score of like 1 to 5, each one, what you would say.
All right. One, I'd say is like a 4.5. Like that's, it's fantastic. It's great. It's a very great premise. Two, I'd give that a 4. That's all right.
Yeah.
That continues on a good idea and takes it into an all right, place. 3, I'd almost give a bit of a 4 as well. Gimmicky, sure, but good showcasey. Continuing on, it would kind of just be a bit of a downward slope until we got back to the New Blood.
Yeah.
That's when it kind of got revitalized, and then 8's just a 1. It's a 0. It's a nothing.
Yeah.
I think overall, I would recommend the 1 through 4, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Without question.
So for me, Friday the 13th, it's iconic, it's amazing, it has Kevin Bacon, it's cool as hell.
I mean, hell yeah.
One of the coolest death scenes with the arrow going through where...
Through the throat? Yeah.
Through the throat. Well, the blood tube came out, and Tom Savini from the pump had to actually go down there and
go
blow on it, so the air bubbles coming up looked like he was actually stabbed through the throat, and he was trying to still breathe. So it was really creepy.
Good effects.
Great effects. The first one, I'd say, 5 out of 5. The second one... I'd say 4 out of 5. Third one, maybe 3.5 out of 5 to 4. I would give it a 4 just because you get the iconic mask. I liked what they were doing with some of the 3D effects,
mm-hmm.
even though a lot of them were really cheesy. But the score, you know what? I'll give it a 4.
It had some heart.
Give it a 4. The final chapter, I'll give a 5 because I think it really bookends everything really well.
Yeah.
5? I don't care what anyone else says. I know people hate it. I give that like a 4 to 4.5.
And that's the thing. I didn't hate it, nor did I really love it. I don't know why people were getting vitriolic about loving it.
I know people hate
or hating
it.
Excuse me.
I think 5. I would give like a 4 to 4.5 because of how extreme it went and how far it was willing to take some of the deaths and take the franchise. Now it was definitely a misdirection that pissed a lot of people off. In the same way Halloween 3 Season of the Witch pissed people off because there was no Michael Myers.
So here's the thing. I think that once we get to 4, I think if you've been down for what it's been doing,
right,
you're kind of at your own risk to go any farther.
Sure. Well, then it redeems itself with 6. I think Jason Lives is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I would give that like a 4.5 to a 5. I would say the New Blood, I've seen that probably the most. It is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people.
As to how it kind of revamps where 3 left off,
right,
in the showcasey, gimmicky, yes, but a bit more technical prowess and actually a lot of good creativity.
Yeah.
And camp.
But a lot
this.
Of people, for some reason, a lot of people hate 7.
Mm-hmm.
I like it a lot. I thought the idea of doing Carrie versus Jason was great. I would give that a 5 out of 5. And then I'd give Jason Takes Manhattan definitely a 1 out of 5. I mean, I'm not going to go down to 0 on it, but out of all of them.
Because you've seen worse.
I've seen way worse. I would say like a 1 to a 1.5. It's definitely the worst of the entire series. It killed off any chance of Paramount being able to capitalize on it into the 90s. Then we end up with other ones, like Jason Goes to Hell, which goes way off the deep end. But that's beside
the
point.
And Jason X and Jason in Space, all this shit.
Yeah, Jason, like, it was... That's where everything started going downhill.
Right.
I love Kane Hodder. I think he's fantastic. But he definitely... some of the worst ones.
I mean, hell, man, like, you got that good job. Like, that's
a
job.
No, it's a great job. He's in some of the worst ones.
I think, to wrap up on, I think that this was a good, interesting first franchise for me to get into. I really enjoyed this. I hopefully won't have to watch so many movies.
Yeah.
Because that was like 12 hours of...
It's a very tedious... It can get tedious after a while, especially if you're binge watching them over
and over. Oh boy. But
there's
some
you have to watch together. 2 through 4, I think is...
That I did that. I actually stopped right at 4.
Yeah.
And then I was like, all right, next one will be done tomorrow.
Nice.
So I like this. I like this idea. I look forward to more. So I think with that, we could probably wrap it up.
Yeah.
That's an ending here for us, for our first franchise examination, from Oh the Horror. I have been Steve Allman.
And I'm still Rob Holmes.
And you can check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, and pretty much everywhere you can find podcasts now, because we're officially back on the scene now for actual podcasters. And this is going to be a real show now. So come and listen to us. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Look at me, Damien. It's all for you.
Come, it is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
When there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk here.